Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Biologist and writer Bill Strever has been diving all his life. Exhale diving, free diving, Alaska diving, saturation diving. He's seen things most of us have never imagined. Shipwrecks, underwater oil fields, spectacular marine life. He dreams of robots roaming the depths of the oceanic landscape from continent to continent, mapping, data collecting, taking pictures of a night dark place that lies beneath the waves. This hour on Point, a lifelong diver's exploration of humanity's depths. Join us. What entrances you about the ocean? The waves? The smell of the sea? The unknown down below the surface? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the shark sightings off of Cape Cod. But first, joining me from Milan, Italy, is Bill Strever. He's a biologist, diver, nonfiction writer, and sailor. His new book is In Oceans Deep, Courage, Innovation, and Adventure Beneath the Waves. Bill Strever, so great to have you with us.
It's great to be on the air with you.
So what drew you to diving, Bill Strever?
It's so long ago, it's hard to remember, but when people ask me that, I always, what goes through my mind is why isn't everybody drawn to diving? For me, I can't look at a body of water without wondering what's underneath, whether it's a pond in a golf course or the middle of the ocean or a wave-swept cliff. Doesn't matter. I'll see it, and right away what goes through my mind is, where's the dive gear? Let's see if we can get in the water.
So many different kinds of diving. Exhale diving, free diving, Alaska diving. What's your favorite kind of diving?
I don't know if I have a favorite. They're all good. They're all varied. Alaska diving is fantastic. There's so much unexplored territory in Alaska that's very accessible. So that's sort of special. But I really don't have a favorite, honestly.
Well, I'll start with saturation diving then. Talk about the breakthrough of saturation diving and what it's meant for the exploration of the ocean.
Okay, well, that's a big topic, but we can jump right into that. So many of your listeners will know about bends. So people get decompression sickness or bends if they go underwater and they stay too long at a certain depth and then surface too quickly, they get bends. So that led to this idea of decompression. If you come up slowly or you come up in stages, you can decompress and the bubbles that are developing in your blood off gas slowly, and therefore you don't get bends. I'm not sure if that makes a lot of sense explained that way, but let's go with that and just say that if you do saturation diving, you're sort of rigging the game so that you go underwater, and instead of staying an hour or 2 hours and then doing a very long decompression to release those gases, you're going down and you're staying a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, as long as you want, because after 24 hours, you're no longer picking up more gas. So say, for example, that you go to 200 feet. If you stay for an hour, it might take you 2 or 3 hours to come to the surface. If you stay for 24 hours, it's going to take you 2 days to come to the surface safely, 2 to 3 days. But if you stay for a month, it's also going to take you 2 to 3 days to come to the surface.
Oh, that's so interesting. I have a clip here, actually, from the Science Channel back in 2014. They spoke with 6 saturation divers employed by an oil company off the coast of Scotland. They typically spend 28 days at a time rotating between work at extreme depths underwater and life inside a pressurized chamber. Here's crew member Ashley Cooper explaining what it's like.
What saturation diving really is, instead of having a dive on a daily basis, you're saturated at the very beginning of your trip, and then you'll make the decompression right at the very end. Saturation diving is multiple dives and then being decompressed right at the very end.
So rigging the game, as you say, Bill Strever.
That's right. And you asked me my favorite kind of diving, and if I had 10 favorite kinds of diving or 10 favorite dives, one of them would be saturation. And I think I have it's been some time since I've been in SAT. Saturation divers usually call it in SAT. But I think I have about 150 days cumulatively in SAT.
Wow.
In my lifetime. So almost half a year. And almost all of those sats were for 28-day shots.
Mm. You know, another interesting diving experience is free diving. When you just reach incredible depths on a single breath. Here's Russian diver Alexei Molchanov coming up for air after breaking the record for the deepest self-propelled dive in freediving history, reaching a depth of 130 meters and resurfacing in 3 minutes and 55 seconds. The diver is celebrated after a judge flashes a white card officiating the feat.
Will it be a white card from the judges? Will Alexei take home this world record here at Vertical Blue 2019?
130 meters, Bill, 3 minutes and 55 seconds. It's incredible.
Absolutely incredible. It's really unbelievable. And in fact, it wasn't that long ago that people did not believe it was possible. And yet what's happening now is that again and again, people are showing what is possible on a single breath. And it's sort of, it's been almost a cultural change, because diving evolved over time to be more and more complex, up to saturation diving and some exotic rebreathers and exotic gases and all this stuff. And then freedivers came along and said, well, wait a minute, let's see what we can do with a pair of fins. Hmm. And not even a pair of fins and a mask. Often freedivers work with nothing on their face at all. So they're just swimming down with fins and swimming back to the surface, or even swimming down with no fins and swimming back to
the
surface.
Wow. And I'm reading about freedivers who often lose consciousness on the way up within a few feet of fresh air. It is hard stuff.
It's hardcore stuff, or it can be if you push the limits. It can also be very enjoyable. So it's really a sport for everyone. And, you know, sometimes I think that people read about the records and see the news coverage on the record, and they think, wow, this is such an extreme sport. When I trained for freediving, which I spent about 7 weeks training freediving in freediving training in Honduras when I was working on this book with a great outfit in Utila called Freedive Utila. But, you know, there were people in that course with me that were national champions from different countries and were really pushing themselves pretty hard. There was also a woman who, if I remember right, a French-Canadian woman who was older than 70. She might have been 72. Had never really spent any time in the water, and she was also training. Hmm. And it was sort of on her bucket list to do this, and I think she got down to 37 feet or something like that, which
wow.
Doesn't sound like much compared to a record, but if you're 72 and you're not really a swimmer,
pretty darn good.
37 feet is impressive.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've spent countless hours below the surface as a commercial diver, as a research biologist. You've spent this book, you wrote this book to try to help us understand the ocean. And I think it's so interesting that in a time of really unprecedented exploration and innovation in so many areas, our oceans are still largely unknown, aren't they, Bill?
They are. They're too unknown, and they're too misunderstood. And, you know, fortunately, that is changing. I think we're going through a burst of activity right now, and I hope to see that burst of activity accelerated. And I hope to see increased public interest around that burst of activity. And, you know, part of that burst of activity, just since I've written the book, things have happened where it's time to revise the book, almost. I mean, I think people should still read the book.
Give us one. Give us one, Bill. What's one burst?
Well, the big one is that an organization called the Five Deeps Expedition announced, I think it was about 2 months or so before the book was released, they announced their intention to dive each of the deep ocean trenches in 5 of the world's oceans, including a return to the Challenger Deep, the deepest point in the ocean that has only been visited twice before by humans. And they not only succeeded, but in the case of the Marianas Trench, they made, I believe, 5 dives. So 5 separate dives in their submersible, 7 miles down, or almost 7 miles down. I think one of the dives was a little bit shallower, set a new absolute record for depth, and took 5 additional people to the bottom of the deepest point in the ocean. So we went from having a very small club of 3 people, one of which has passed away but from natural causes, mm-hmm. to now having a club that's got, 8 people in it.
Wow.
So 8 people have been to the deepest point in the ocean, fewer than have been to the moon.
We actually have a clip of that in May. A Dallas businessman and diver, Victor Vescovo, successfully reached the Challenger Deep, which, again, as you say, is Earth's deepest ocean floor. This was part of the Five Deeps Expedition, a mission to reach the bottom of each of the Earth's 5 oceans.
At bottom. Repeat. at bottom.
At the bottom?
Yep.
Yee-hoo! Yeah!
Roger, LF, understand you are on the bottom. Congratulations, Victor. Congratulations.
That's incredible, Bill.
Indeed. Congratulations to Victor. Just amazing. And, you know, I don't know if people appreciate it, but it's not only amazing that he did it, but it's even more amazing that he did it four or five times and then also did some other ocean trenches around the world. This is just absolutely incredible what happened here.
What is so entrancing to you about the ocean, Bill Streever?
Oh, everything. It still remains an accessible place for people to explore. You don't have to have the wealth of a Victor to go out and explore the oceans. There's plenty of shallow areas that are not explored. You can explore with a mask and a snorkel. You can explore with scuba gear. If you want to go steps further, you can invest in rebreathers and go deeper, stay longer, this kind of thing. So the ocean is just, for me, is this constant draw to get underwater and to explore what's there and to look at it in different ways. So, sure, it's great to see whale sharks, for example, or manta rays, or even ordinary whales, just gigantic animals. And it's fantastic to see huge schools of fish or very bizarre fish, like frogfish, for example, or squid or octopus. But even things like plankton, you know, it's just fascinating to look at the plankton drifting by.
We're discussing the immense beauty and the extreme dangers of the deep sea with Bill Streever. His new book is In Oceans Deep. You can join the conversation, listeners, deep sea divers, snorkelers. What have you seen in your explorations? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the mysteries of the deep sea and the technological innovations that bring us closer to them this hour. You can join the conversation. What kinds of encounters have you had under the waves? Submariners, scuba divers, free divers? We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with biologist and writer Bill Streever. His new book is In Oceans Deep, Courage, Innovation, and Adventure Beneath the Waves. I've got a long line of calls on the board. Let's go to John first in Panama City, Florida. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. This is for Bill. In his wonderful chapter on free diving, he talks about the risk of lung squeeze. And one way to avoid the risk of lung squeeze, I'm aware of, is to fill the lungs with liquid. Now, having seen the competitive spirit of free divers, Bill, do you think any elite divers have considered such an artificial enhancement?
Good question, John. Thanks. Bill?
Yeah, I guess I should start out by recognizing John. John, I recognize his voice and, of course, his name, but John was the lead scientist at the U.S. Navy's Experimental Diving Unit in Panama City, Florida for, I believe, decades.
Oh my.
So this was a person who knows diving.
He knows
well,
what he's doing, yeah.
Cutting edge diving.
Yeah.
So what he's suggesting is, you know, as a free diver goes down, as her chest is compressed, as the pressure increases outside, it squeezes the lungs, and over time, or over depth rather, the lungs become smaller and smaller until, you know, they're basically, in a sense, destroyed. But one of the real challenges of getting deep in free dives is the so-called lung squeeze. And I know John has been involved in experiments before and lots of theoretical discussions about what happens if you flood a person's lungs. And the idea with I guess you would call it ordinary diving, even though it's with flooded lungs, would be to use a fluid that could carry oxygen to the lungs. But in this case, with free diving, it would just be to prevent chest squeeze. Hmm. So John's question is, do I think people would be interested in doing that? And, you know, I think you'd actually have a really long line of free divers volunteering to do that. There would be some that might be overcome with good judgment at the last minute and not do it, but I think you would have a long line of people eager to try it. Hmm. And honestly, I think I would put my hand up too, and I don't know that I would do it. I would want to go to the safety briefing first and see what the chances were, but it sounds like quite an experience. Hmm.
John, thanks so much for the call. Bill, I want you to tell us about the Trieste, the 1960 Challenger Deep Navy mission. It was a milestone in underwater exploration. I've got a clip here. Donald Walsh was a former Navy lieutenant, co-piloted a U.S. Navy submersible craft called the Trieste. It was to the deepest part of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean. That was in 1960. Here he is at the National Museum of the United States Navy in 2012 explaining the science behind this incredible vessel.
Basically, it is an underwater balloon. You've got two parts to it. You've got the balloon here, which is this long cylindrical object, and that's filled with a lighter-than-water substance, which is aviation gasoline. Oil floats on water. So you get buoyancy or lift. And then beneath the balloon, like a balloon up in the air, you have a cabin for the fragile humans.
And here he is talking about what it feels like to reach the deepest point of our oceans, this back in 1960.
We shook hands, and we're kind of pleased that we had done something.
I think it was a feeling of exuberance, a calm feeling of, well, we did it.
Life magazine had a small camera fixed inside the cabin, so we triggered that and took a picture of the two of us sitting there. Mm.
Tell us about that moment in deep sea exploration, Bill. It was certainly a milestone.
It was a milestone, and I had the good fortune to meet Don and to interview him while I was working on this book. And Don has been a hero of mine as long as I can remember, since I was a child. But what they did was absolutely amazing. So he pretty much explained the mission on the clips that he played. But even today, Don, who's now, I believe, in his 80s, he's the sort of very self-effacing legend of a man. He's still very active in deep-sea exploration. I believe he was present during the Five Deeps expeditions, recent dives to the bottom of the Challenger Deep. I just can't say enough great things about Don. But I will say that after that mission, they surfaced, everything was fine, and, you know, it certainly didn't necessarily have to turn out that way. There were real dangers involved, and still are, with this kind of diving.
It was scary. It was seven vertical miles down, right? The deepest point of the ocean. And we got there in 1960 and didn't get back there until 2012. Is that right? James Cameron, the director, made his way back there. Why'd it take so long?
That's exactly right. So and let's have some perspective here. So 7 miles of depth, next time you're on a commercial airline flight, look out the window, you're often about 7 miles above the surface. Or if you took Mount Everest and plopped it down in the Challenger Deep, the peak of Mount Everest would be over a mile beneath the waves. So 7 miles down, a long ways down, tremendous pressure. Don and his partner made it to the bottom. They came back up. The Navy released a press release that said, in effect, the U.S. now possesses the capability for manned exploration of the sea down to the deepest part of its floor, and talked about dominating the depths and all this kind of stuff. And then almost immediately after that, they reclassified the Trieste and limited her dives to only 20,000 feet. Still very deep. I say only 20,000 feet. That's still remarkably deep, but it's not 35,000 feet. So all of a sudden, they had this vehicle that they weren't going to use again, and people thought, well, it'll be a few more years before we get down there. Well, a few years turned out to be 2012,
right,
when a largely private sector effort funded by National Geographic, Rolex, and some others made it back to the bottom. And then, very surprisingly, last year, the Five Deeps expedition that had prepared for this their dives, they prepared in secret, so all of a sudden, out of the blue, they put out this press release, we're ready to go back. and we're going to do a whole bunch of deep dives. It almost, when I first read their press release, I almost couldn't believe it. And was That's very incredible. Skeptical that they would pull it off, and yet they have. They pulled sure it did. Off in spades. Mm.
Yeah. Another call in here from Robert in Portland, Maine. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I spent a number of years as a Navy SEAL around the world diving in some extreme locations, and I've had some absolutely amazing, unbelievable memories and experiences.
Give us one, Robert. Give us one.
Oh, doing a simple, very simple 130-foot bounce dive in pretty rough waters, overcast sky, and going down, and then coming back up, ascending around 70 feet to decompress and rotating on the line and seeing a gray whale just right there 50, 60 feet away from me, just stationary. And I'm watching the eye move and focus on me. I'm focused on this whale. It's very surreal. That's one wow. amazing example.
Wow. Robert, thank you. Thank you so much. Bill, do you have an example like that, a wow moment underwater?
So many, but one that's sort of like that is diving in near Thailand in the South China Sea, and we were using impact wrenches, which make noise, pneumatic impact wrenches, to put things together. And the noise was bringing in whale sharks. So we would be working away, and you're usually pretty focused on your work, and all of a sudden the shadow passes over you, and you look up, and there's this 30-foot-long fish swimming between you and the sunlight 200 feet above.
Robert, thanks so much for the call. Let's get Patrick in here in Sebastian, Florida. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So I thought I would call in. Bill had mentioned to me that he was going to be with you on Point today in NPR, by the way, one of my favorite radio stations. And I thought I would call in because I am the president and co-founder of Triton Submarines, the very same company that built that full ocean depth sub that has been traveling around the world in the last 9 months, diving to the deepest point in each of the five oceans.
Oh, interesting. How many people have you taken around, Patrick?
So the primary objective is to enable Victor to achieve his personal objective of diving to each of the deepest points in the five oceans. But as a secondary goal, we're also conducting some significant scientific dives, and those involve carrying two people on each dive. Starting in the Puerto Rican Trench, where we reached a depth of around 8,500 meters, then the Southern Ocean, we were in the South Sandwich Trench, and I think that was around 7,400 meters. I don't have the specific numbers, but you can see them mm-hmm. either on our Triton website or the Five Deeps website. Then the Java Trench, and then most recently, as you discussed a few moments ago, to the Challenger Deep, which is the deepest point in the Marianas Trench. I'm very pleased, you know, with our success there. We made five dives over the course of 10 days, and during that time, we increased the number of people who've been to full ocean depth from 3 to 7. Two of the dives were done with Victor in a solo capacity, where he achieved a depth of 10,928 meters, about 35,840 feet, I think it is. And then after he did his two solo dives, we did the DNVGL certification dive. That's significant because the vehicles that have preceded the Triton 36002, or the limiting factor, as Victor calls it, have been experimental craft. You know, they were designed to make a dive.
Right.
But we wanted to build something that would dive repeatedly to Hadal depths, or to depths between 6 and 11,000 meters, between 20 and 36,000 feet, because it's a part of our ocean that we know almost nothing about. And the idea was to try and get people engaged with this type of exploration and to hopefully create some excitement and some interest around ocean exploration.
Well, that's so interesting, Patrick. Thank you for the call. Bill Strever, there's Triton Submarines. I mean, you've visited a luxury submarine factory where billionaires are spending a lot of money to create vessels to get them down deep, right?
Oh, that's right. I also visited Triton, and a very, very impressive company, absolutely amazing. And it's in a suburban area in Florida, just hidden away basically in a warehouse, and they're making these not only incredible but actually beautiful machines. And Patrick didn't mention it, but I'm fairly sure that he was one of the people that went to the bottom of the Challenger Deep in this recent expedition.
Let's get Tony in here from Spring Breen, Wisconsin. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys?
Hi, good. Go ahead.
I would like to just bring this conversation out to all those little guys out there, boys and girls who are thinking about doing this. I come from Wisconsin, but I have to go to the Caribbean to dive, and that's I do it all the time. And when young people ask me, why do you do it, why do you do it, I really, really get them looking at their eyes. I get their curiosity up, and I just say, because it's the only place you will ever go in your whole life that's truly different.
Mm-hmm.
And I hold their gaze as long as I can. And I tell you, that gets them.
That's so interesting. Tony, thanks for the call. Bill Strever, you know, only three people have been to the bottom of the deepest ocean trench. 12 people have walked on the moon, right? A quarter million miles away. The ocean, the deepest ocean trench is what, 7 vertical miles, and the moon is a quarter million miles away. It really puts into perspective how much there still is to learn in our oceans.
That's right, and I think it's 7 people now have been to the bottom of the Challenger Deep, and then another person had been deep in the Mariana Trench, thanks to the Five Deeps expedition. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the most recent caller in talking about young divers. You know, one thing that's happened in the last, say, I don't know, 20 years, diving really has been opened up to children. So, and you know, clearly parental permission and lots of instruction and lots of care, but I've seen children as young as 5, 6 years old with the scuba tank swimming around in the oceans.
You know, my 14 and 13-year-old just certified as scuba divers last year, and they made it it was a real fun effort over a couple of years to get certified. And boy, they have had the greatest time. It's quite an adventure. Bob is in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hey. How you guys doing today?
Hello.
Well, the nature of my comment is more on the use of robotics, just as in outer space, now in inner space. The role of robotics has been expanding substantially. My company is SeaTrepid in Louisiana, where I'm the CEO of the company, the founder. And specifically, Bill did a lot of work on this particular subject because the knowledge of man is slowly rolling back the unknowns within this deep sea. I wanted to see what Bill's take on the role of robotics in the exploration of the deep sea as man goes forward.
Bob, thank you. Bill Strever, tell us about robots and their capability actually of roving unsupervised between continents.
Well, sure thing. And I think that was Bob Christ, who's well known in the world of ROVs. So ROVs, as they're called, remotely operated vehicles, sort of came into the scene around 1953 when a Frenchman who was working with Cousteau, named Dmitry Rybakov, I think, invented an ROV that he called Poodle. And then shortly after that, the Navy started using their own versions of an ROV for torpedo recoveries, and they called it CURV, for cable-controlled underwater recovery vehicle. And then, you know, at that time, there were very few ROVs in the world. Say around 1974 or 1975, there were maybe 20 ROVs worldwide. 10 years later, there were 500. Mm. Now there's thousands. And most of these ROVs are connected to the surface by a cable, and someone sitting on the surface has a joystick and a video screen and other sophisticated gear, and they're controlling the ROV. But over time, the disadvantage of a cable became apparent, especially very long cables, like, for example, 7 miles of cable with currents pulling at it and tugging the ROV around on the bottom. It's just not really feasible. Hmm. So along came this idea of, let's program these ROVs, put a battery pack in them so they don't have to be powered from the surface, toss them over the side, tell them to go do a mission and come back and meet us back here on the surface in a day, 2 days, 3 days, whatever it's going to take. And these are called AUVs, or autonomous underwater vehicles. So now the underwater world is populated by human divers, it's populated by ROVs, the cabled ROVs, and it's populated by AUVs. And at least one AUV, called a type of AUV called a glider, went across the Atlantic Ocean underwater.
And are they collecting data? Are they mapping? What are they doing exactly?
It depends on the ROV. Some are mapping, some are collecting data, some are on search and recovery, some are doing mechanical work, for example, in oil fields, salvage work. So lots and lots of activities. You might remember there was a tragic incident in 2017 when the Argentinians lost a submarine called, I think, the San Juan, disappeared. Location uncertain, couldn't be found. It was relocated using AUVs in 2019. The wreckage, unfortunately, was located in 2019 using AUVs.
Wow.
We are discussing the world's last frontier, the underwater depths, with Bill Strever. His new book is In Oceans Deep, Courage, Innovation, and Adventure Beneath the Waves. You can join the conversation, listeners. How can we protect the ocean for the next generation? More calls to get to after the break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves. Resting our head on the seabed in an octopus's garden near a cave. We would sing and dance around because we know we can't be found. I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the past, present, and future of underwater exploration this hour, and you can join the conversation. Do you see automation and artificial intelligence helping or hurting our search to understand the seas? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook and On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Bill Strever, author of the new book, In Oceans Deep, Courage, Innovation, and Adventure Beneath the Waves. Back to the phones, Mary Lou in Tonawanda, New York. Hi, Mary Lou. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I think that diving in the ocean is a wonderful lifelong sport. I'm 86 years old. I started diving when I turned 50. It's been one of the brightest spots of my life. And diving, people don't realize that it's so easy on the body compared to many heavy physical activities. That it's just been something I've continued to do and hope to do for years ahead.
That's fantastic. Where's your favorite spot, Mary Lou?
Oh, my favorite spot is the north shore of Little Cayman Island, which is a marine park protected by the Cayman government. And so it has beautiful access to both shallow and deep walls. It's an exciting place. And I do this, my main interest is photography. And, of course, it's a beautiful place to do that.
On the board here, I say my producer wrote, you have arthritis, but when you dive, you don't feel it.
That's right. I have quite a bit of arthritis in my knees, but once I'm diving, I don't have the gravity pulling on me. I have no trouble at all, and I can dive for hours without any discomfort.
Yeah, I love it. 86 years young. Mary Lou, thanks so much for the call. Good luck to you. Here's Bill in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
And you bet.
I just wanted to share a thought with Bill and ask his point. I've been a diver. Next year will be 40 years, and I have dived a lot of different places, but I've been in the Tampa Bay now for most, probably half of it. And over the 20 years, I have just seen the sea look like it's dying. I mean, we're pumping so much stuff into the oceans, everything from Fukushima to seeing red tide. Just the other day, we had 92 degrees in clear water. I've never seen 92 degrees for the Gulf temperature. And, we have the disturbances that are off New Orleans right now. Does he believe we can turn the tide on all this pollution and plastic? And he talks about innovation. What does he see the future for us to clean up our pollution?
Good question, Bill. Thank you so much. Bill Strever, talk about ocean conservation here.
Yeah, let's talk about ocean conservation. And I guess the first thing I want to say about it is, I often hear people say, oh, the oceans are fragile, the reefs are fragile. That's not true. If that were true, they would be gone. Okay, so first of all, we're talking about very robust ecosystems that are being very significantly damaged, and not by any one thing, but sort of by death by a thousand cuts. Mm. So there's sewage, there's pesticides, there's fertilizers, oil spills, stormwater drainage, plastics. Plastics have been in the news a lot lately. They're turning up everywhere. Changes in pH, which is kind of a part of CO2 emissions and part related to climate change, but changes in pH of the water, which has tremendous impacts on anything that relies on calcium carbonate for a skeleton, so shellfish, for example. Overfishing, exotic species, what else, sediment runoff, underwater noise. Mm. So tremendous amounts of noise going into the water that have impacts that we don't even understand right now. Mm. And we know they're bad, though. We know that lots and lots of underwater noise is not a good thing. Dead zones, Nancy Rablis in Louisiana is a professor who's studied so-called dead zones for years, and it turns out that there's lots and lots of them all over the planet that are caused by things that human beings are putting into the water that are exhausting the oxygen supply in the water and killing everything in huge regions. So when we talk about marine ecosystems, you know, if they were fragile, we wouldn't have them anymore. They're not fragile, but we are sacrificing them, and marine ecosystems are damaged. So the caller's question was, did I think we could turn this around? Probably not in our lifetimes, but we can certainly slow down the level of damage and hopefully eventually reverse it, and then over time let the oceans recover. But the recovery process isn't something that's going to happen in our lifetimes.
Bill, thanks so much for that important question with your call. I want to play this clip. Bill Strever, legendary marine biologist and diver Sylvia Earle, explained why the ocean is so important. This is from a May episode of the PBS NewsHour.
What's hard is getting people to understand why the ocean matters to them. If the ocean dried up tomorrow, life would also dry up. That's where most of the action on Earth is. It's 97% of the water on Earth. They should know that with every breath they take, every drop of water they drink, the ocean is touching them.
Sums it up quite beautifully. I'm going to go back to the phones. Mike in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. My first instinct was, is this going to be the same pattern that we just saw with Mount Everest, where luxury tourism destroys what's left? So I'd like to ask your guest if in 20 years do we have $100,000 tourists going to the bottom of the ocean that causes the same kind of problems we're seeing on Mount Everest?
Great question, Mike. Thank you. Bill Strever?
Well, I certainly hope not, and I think most of the people that are involved in deep ocean exploration are conservationists. And Sylvia Earle, who we just heard, is always quick to point out that the best way to turn somebody into an ocean conservationist is to get them underwater. So I don't think you're going to see the kinds of people that are doing deep dives or even shallow dives. They're not going to be trashing the place like what's happened on Everest. And I'll also point out, of course, the deep sea is way, way bigger than the trail that leads to the summit of Mount Everest.
Let's go to one last call here. Edward in Miami, Florida. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call, and I find this program that you're putting on very interesting. When I was in university, I took a course that had to do with ecology, and one of the things I found most interesting was whale fall, when the whales die and they get to the bottom of the ocean. There's all sorts of fascinating life that feeds on the carcass. But, of course, these things are out of sight and out of mind. So I think books like the ones that your guests produce are very important to sort of put the light on what is essentially an ecosystem that's very hidden, very different, but still being impacted by a lot of the things that humans do, like deep-sea trawling. Mm. So for sure, we need more efforts like this.
Edward, thank you. Thank you very much. Bill Strever, space is often called the final frontier, but your book makes it very clear that the ocean is still quite distant. There's so much more to discover and to understand. What's the message you want to leave our listeners today?
Well, I guess a key message would be that we can all be part of this. This doesn't have to be the playground of the rich, like one of the earlier callers suggested might happen. This is a place for all of us. The oceans belong to all of us, and all of us have a responsibility to protect our oceans and to improve the quality of our oceans.
You live on a sailboat, is that right, with your wife and co-captain?
That's right. My wife is a marine biologist and my co-captain. We live on our sailboat currently in Colombia.
And
are you
perpetually at sea? What's your route?
No, I don't think anybody's perpetually at sea, but we're often at sea, and we're very slowly making our way around the world, and we tell each other if we get around the world in less than 10 years, we have failed.
And do you just stop and kind of go diving wherever you are? What's your procedure?
You got it. Pretty much we're diving frequently. I have an ROV on board. We have normal scuba gear on board. We have a free diving gear on board. We were doing some rebreather diving in Bonaire recently. So we're all about diving, and we get on submersibles whenever we can.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time for coming on shore to speak with us. Bill Strever, his new book is In Oceans Deep, Courage, Innovation, and Adventure Beneath the Waves. Bill, thank you, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
In a moment, why are there more sharks prowling around the shores of Cape Cod? We'll have that in just a minute. This is On Point. Shark sightings are up on Cape Cod this summer. To explain the science and how it's impacting tourism is Doug Fraser from the Cape Cod Times. He joins us from Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, Doug. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
So nice to have you. Tell us what's going on with these shark sightings off of Cape Cod.
So it's primarily been the rise of the gray seal population. They're relatively large seals, 300 to 800 pounds. The population's been going up ever since the Marine Mammal Protection Act was instituted in 1972. Went from almost zero in the 70s to about, depending on which study you believe, mid-20s to as much as 50,000 gray seals now. And the sharks, as the biologists say, kind of take a left-hand turn and discover this cafe where they can dine on seals. And basically, we've seen shark sightings go up ever since probably the tagging study started in like around 2009.
So is the balance out of whack a little bit? I mean, what are you know, ecologists saying with the Marine Mammal Protection Act? Is it sort of in balance now?
Well, certainly there's been a critique from locals, fishermen, others that the ecosystem is out of balance, but they don't really know what that true balance really is, to be honest. You know, it could be in the process of reestablishing some type of balance, but to put it in perspective, you know, since human beings have, you know, put their fingerprint on the ocean, basically, they're not quite sure what that true balance is going to be, at least the scientists that I talk to. So now you have the seal populations going up and the numbers of sharks coming in, and the white shark, and that's the shark we're talking about, the great white shark, those numbers now are considered by the most recent studies to be on the upswing as well, both here and due to protections kind of around the globe, you know. And so that's the problem, is we're starting to see not only more sharks coming into our area, but the general population is on the upswing.
I'm watching these videos online. They're compelling.
Very close to shore, a lot of those.
Yeah. Tell us more about that.
So that's the difference between here and a lot of other areas. Most the great whites like to attack their surprise hunters, so they like to ambush their prey, and they usually do it from depths of around 10 feet or deeper. But here they've learned to attack laterally because they have to. The seals hug the shoreline, and they are in and amongst the swimmers, and they're hard to avoid, the seals, and the sharks are also in and among the swimmers. There's been plenty of video of those attacks happening within like a few feet of shore, really, you know. So the problem, the good thing is that, you know, there's enough sharks around, maybe potentially like in the hundreds, that they don't really tend to, you know, choose humans the way tigers choose humans, for instance, in some areas of the world. And what we have are relatively few attacks, but of course they're so big that they can do a lot of damage with a single bite.
How are towns on Cape Cod responding to this? I'm reading about locks boxes on the beach with tourniquets and landline access and dune buggy services to transport people. What are you seeing out there, Doug?
Well, so far, the you know, they have been able to get some state grants. They've they utilize their own money. They're mostly trying to backfill the emergency, the gaps in like response and also treatment that became evident after the fatal attack last year. And there's been four other attacks as well. And that sort of revealed that there were issues with, you know, this is kind of, I don't want to say wilderness, but let's just say this is remote territory, you know, and so the problems with cell phone connection and communications to get a 911 line, for instance, when you only have a few minutes to respond to a potential bleed out, those gaps are what they're filling now. And they're also trying to educate people in terms of, like, trying to stay as safe as possible, remain out of areas where you potentially could encounter a shark, like deep water areas at the edge of a sandbar, and particular times of the day. But that science is evolving. We're now having studies that are being done this year that look at the shark behavior when they are in the shallow water and they are hunting.
I saw Chatham residents on Cape Cod narrowly rejected a proposal to spend $100,000 on a shark barrier at a beach, beaches where kids are taking swimming lessons and otherwise sort of in the water. You know, we're right in the middle of tourist season. How are people on the Cape sort of handling this? What are tourists doing?
Well, if you went to the beaches, you'd see a lot of people in the water. You know, it's hot here, and the water's been fairly warm. People tend to, like, there's two things they do. Number one, they have very graphic signs that warn you at the beaches that there are sharks in the water. I mean, it's a photo, and there's no mistaking what this shark is, you know. People like to have their pictures taken beside that for some reason. I find it odd, but a lot of people do it. And when you go down to the beach themselves, there's a mix of opinions, you know. Usually people are fairly well informed. There's been a lot of education work that's been done here. And so they know the sharks are there, but the feeling is with the lifeguards there and the fact that, you know, people tend not to go, like, really deep, that they feel there's enough safety there that people go in for now. Mm-hmm. You know, that's you don't know what will happen should another attack, you know, occur, which people say is pretty much inevitable, you know. But amongst the locals, and especially the water user groups, those are the people that when shark attacks happen, no matter where they happen in the world, they tend to be the people that are most impacted because they tend to be, you know, the long-distance swimmers, the surfers, the paddleboarders, the bodyboarders. Those are the people that the sharks tend to, you know, attack, let's just say, because they're usually somewhat isolated from other people. They're usually in deeper water, and they stay in a lot longer. Those people have been expressing a lot of concern, including people who have surfed all over the world. We do have those people here. And they say, this is different. This is different from what they've seen in other parts of the world. And they want more activity on the part of the towns and the state and even the federal government. They want to see, you know, some kind of measures for detection or deterrence for sharks those measures have not necessarily proven successful elsewhere. There's not a lot of science behind them, but they want to see some activity on that front.
Doug Fraser covers the environment, fisheries, and sharks for the Cape Cod Times. Doug, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful. and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.